priest is seated next to me in full white and gold robes. His spectacles slide down his nose as he sleeps. Every now and again, with exhausting frequency, he wakes me by touching my arm, indicating that he needs me to step out of my seat so he can go to the toilet. His rosary beads swing from the coat hook above us. I sit through this night, too hot and then too cold, wondering what it is I have done, what I am doing here, reading a battered copy of a Czech novel, pressed into my hands by a friend as we said goodbye, along with a tiny package that contained a compass, because, as he wrote in the accompanying card, it was important for me to find my way back. I am in the wrong life, or so I think. I am off course. I am spinning in space in more ways than one. I have left behind the life I was supposed to be leading, and here I am instead, on a plane heading for Hong Kong, a city where I have no job, no prospects, and know only one person. Crossing time zones in this way can bring upon you an unsettling, distorted clarity. Is it the altitude, the unaccustomed inactivity, the physical confinement, the lack of sleep, or a collision of all four? Travelling at speed thousands of feet above ground in the cabin of an aircraft induces an altered state of mind. Things that may have been puzzling you perhaps come into focus, as if the lens of a camera has been twisted. You may find, sliding into your mind, answers to questions that have long eluded you. As you gaze out at the illusory landscape of Altostratus Mountains, you may catch yourself thinking, "Ah, of course, I hadn't realized that before." I hold the compass in one hand, a Hong Kong map in the other. A perplexing, incomprehensible tangle of streets, elevations, tunnels, islands and harbours, with everything marked in Chinese characters. It seems to me that the act of walking away from my friend, yesterday, today, the day before, has unloosed something within me, almost as if he has retained the end of some vital thread, and my leaving means that it has been unravelling ever since, stretching out between me and all that I have left behind. How far can it extend, and will it break, and shall I ever be able to wind it back in? The question comes to me slowly, creeping up on me, overtaking me and wreathing itself around me like a fog, as the plane flies inexorably on. Why am I leaving? How come I am going away? At university, I sat opposite this man most days in the library, and we revised for our finals together. We kicked each other, under the desk, gently, insistently, if our attention wandered. He would wordlessly imitate the way I shook out the muscle cramp in my hand. He made sure I didn't forget to eat lunch. When I told him I wanted to write, he didn't laugh, but tilted his head in a serious, thoughtful fashion, as if letting this idea find its place in his mind. Somehow, though, I am on this plane and I am heading towards a different man. I have, in short, no idea what I'm doing. I ought, or so it seems to me, to be moving into a flat in Cambridge. I should be oiling the chain of my bicycle. I should be going up and down the steps of the university library, carrying books and periodicals. I should be starting my PhD. I should be sitting in my usual seat, opposite my friend, who is at this very moment embarking on his own PhD, alone, without me. Instead, I am here, on my way to Hong Kong, because 4 months ago, I went to look for my degree results, which were displayed on a board, and instead of the result I had been hoping for, the result I needed to secure postgraduate funding, the result I had wanted and worked for, I had nothing near it, nothing even close. Something I realized as I turned away from the board, as I stumbled down the steps, as I climbed back onto my bicycle, ignoring the calls from other people, had gone terribly, horribly wrong. So here I am. I will not become an academic. I will not be staying at Cambridge. I will not see my friend for a long time. I will not be doing a PhD on the deceptively marginal roles of women in medieval poetry. My thesis, which would have argued that the anonymous poet of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight was female, will remain unwritten. I have for months now, ever since my plans caved in, caught glimpses of the poem as if out of the corner of my eye, and have had to turn away from it because its loss from my life is too great. the celebratory meal interrupted by the fearfully courteous giant, the poet's lingering, admiring description of his physique. For of back and of breast all were his body's torn, both his wombe and his waist were worthily smail. Her luxurious indulgence in colour and decoration, pattern and textile, the way she, I was always so sure she was a she, deftly distracts you like a conjurer from the central mystery with an array of handsome men and their clothes, their armour, their beards, and their somewhat ridiculous fights. The intriguing and modern-seeming way she would change tense in the middle of a stanza. And the doltish Gawain, who has no idea what he's got himself into, who overlooks the old woman at the castle, entirely missing the whole point of the confusing web spun around him. It has all gone. I must shut the door on it. And her. I liked my connection with her, through the words of the story. I relied on it. I felt as though I had reached back through time, down through the pages of the book, and taken hold of her hand. But I must give her up. I won't read the book again for many years. At the time, as I fly across the Pacific Ocean, aged 21, it feels as if something crucial to my very existence, a heart, a lung, an artery, has been snatched away from me. In a year or so, I will realize that the mess I made of my finals was nothing of the sort. In a few years more, it will seem to me that it was a merciful escape, that my guardian angel, glancing down from her cloud and seeing me cycle to my exams, perceived what might happen and let slip a celestial spanner that well and truly jammed my works. The truth is that I would have been a terrible academic. I am too volatile, too skittish, too impatient. Once I had written my paean to the Gawain poet, I would have been miserable poring over ancient manuscripts in a library for the rest of my life. The opacity of Middle English would have driven me mad. I wouldn't have made a good teacher either. I'm haunted, for one thing, by a stammer. How could I have stood up at the front of a class? How could I have ever thought I could deliver a lecture? I would have been beside myself with boredom and rage and frustration within a month or two, probably left Cambridge and done something else. Maybe I would have ended up in Hong Kong anyway. Of course, I don't know this as I sit on the plane. I'm still submerged in panic and grief, still mourning the loss of what I felt was central to my identity. My grades and my ability to produce them out of a hat were the only thing I had, the only thing I was good at. I was not amiable or affable, and never would be. I had strange and unruly hair. I was verbally challenged. I had mysterious neurological problems, but from my early teens, this was the kind of alchemy I could pull off. You were given the work, you revised the work, hard, very hard, with timetables and test papers and clocks and early starts and late nights, with notes and highlighters and index cards. Then you reproduced it in an exam hall, and then, abracadabra, you received a piece of shiny paper saying you had passed go, you had won £200, you had a get-out-of-jail-free card. It had worked for years, this formula. It had taken me through two comprehensive schools, one frightening and bewildering, one less so. Then on to Cambridge, through my first year and second year, and then suddenly, in my third, final and most important year of all, the spell stopped working. It wore off. What I wish I had known, age 21, as I cycled away from the results board towards the meadow by the river in Cambridge, where I would throw stones into the water and cry, is that nobody ever asks you what degree you got. It ceases to matter the moment you leave university, that the things in life which don't go to plan are usually more important, more formative in the long run than the things that do. You need to expect the unexpected, to embrace it. The best way, I am about to discover, is not always the easy way. So I am heading to Hong Kong, because I have to get away, because I don't speak any languages besides inept German. Ich habe alle meine Hausaufgaben gemacht. Because Britain is in the grip of a recession and there are no jobs, especially for someone with an unremarkable degree in English literature. Because Anton, who went out to Hong Kong a while ago, has written to me and said, come, you'll easily get a job here, you can stay with me. because this appears to be the best thing to do, because at 21 it seems a perfectly feasible plan to leave and go all the way across the world with just a rucksack and no money and the promise of a place to stay, because why not? What else do I have to lose? There is no warning, just a sudden clunking noise and the sensation of a cold wind flowing through the cabin. Suddenly, the plane is falling, dropping, plummeting like a rock thrown from a cliff. The downwards velocity is astonishing, the drag, the speed of it. It feels like the world's most unpleasant fairground ride, like a dive into nothing, like being pulled by the ankles into the endless maw of the underworld. My ears and face bloom petals of pain, the seatbelt cutting into my thighs as I'm thrown upwards. Around me, the cabin is shaken like a snow globe. Handbags, juice cans, apples, shoes, sweaters rise from the floor. Oxygen masks swing like lianas from the ceiling, and human beings are tossed into the air. I see the child from across the aisle hit the roof, feet first, his mother arcing in the other direction, her black hair fanned out around her, her face more disgruntled than afraid. The priest next to me is thrown upwards and out of his seat towards his rosary beads. Two nuns, their wimples billowing, are flung like rag dolls up to the lights. The air is filled with screaming, with curses, with prayer. A man with blood coursing out of both nostrils starts to yell in a language I don't understand, gesticulating wildly. Drops of blood scatter from his face to mark the seats, the ceiling. Still the plane falls. An air hostess crawls along the aisle. She is screaming, her hat askew, her hair spilling over her shoulder. Another crew member, a man coming in the opposite direction, stumbles over her blindly. He is shouting about masks, about how we must put them on, but he is thrown upwards before anyone can hear him. What I feel is not so much calm as numbed resignation. I think, so now this. I think, this is one of the worst things I have ever seen. I think we are going to die, all of us, right now. We will hit the ocean or the ground at speed, and we will explode like cans of soda. There will be nothing left, total obliteration. There is an odd relief in being alone. I glance around at people clinging to their companions, their relatives, crying, screaming, holding on tight. I grip the seat arms and tell myself, here it comes. There is no flashing of life before the eyes. No final reckoning takes place, no onslaughts of wisdom, no last-minute wishes or requests or prayers. I don't think about all the other times I've managed to hoodwink this moment, slip from its grasp. I am suffused, preoccupied, distracted by the physical, the deafening noise of the aircraft, of people's panic, the assaulting drag of the fall, the bracing of my body for the inevitable impact. At some point, the priest must have taken my arm, because when we stop falling, when the plane seems to come up against something, we are all violently thrown upwards again before finally levelling out, and I feel the clench of his fingers near my elbow, his rosary beads pressing into my flesh. In a day or two, Anton will ask me what the strange row of marks on my arm is, and I will look down and see them, a novena of bruises. When we land in Hong Kong, most of the passengers are taken away for medical treatment, including my priest. I carry his bag for him to the door of the ambulance. When we say goodbye, he places his hand on my head and mutters a blessing in Latin. Although I am no longer a believer, although I have rejected that whole part of my upbringing, I stand there on the runway under his hand until it is over. I can still feel the imprint of his fingers on the top of my head, like the circlet of an invisible crown, when I come through the gate to find Anton waiting for me. He looks different, wearing a loose white cotton shirt, his hair shorn close and dark to his scalp. I get a job 2 days later, coaching school children in English literature, easing them towards good grades. I sit in a partitioned booth above the harbour and help them through Romeo and Juliet, through Seamus Heaney's Naturalist, through the motivations of Arthur Miller's Salesman. I teach a girl who is about to be sent to a boarding school in Hertfordshire how to use a knife and fork. She asks me to help her choose an English name, and I attempt to steer her away from winsome or delicate, which she has found in the dictionary. I take Cantonese lessons. Yat, yi, sam, say, m. I eat congee every morning at a street-side stall. I swim in the South China Sea and pick up shells with my toes. I travel up the side of a peak in a slant-floored tram. I consider the newspapers, the features, the interviews, the book and film reviews, and ask myself, that, could I maybe do that? I write letters on frail-skinned blue aerograms. Anton teaches me to use a single-lens reflex camera, and I go out with it and photograph everything. People taking their caged birds for a walk, old ladies doing Tai Chi in the morning, Mahjong players in the park, children dressed up as dragons, the flattened ducks in restaurant windows, the trams, the neon scribbled in the dark sky, the pyramids of durians and tanks of tofu in the night markets. I join the British Council Library, scrabbling together the necessary forms and photocopies and proofs of address. I tread the carpet along the rows of fiction A to Z and think, I can read whatever I want. The realization arrives like a gale lashing past me, almost making me stagger. No more courses, no more curricula, no more exams for me. I take out 3 books, and days later, I'm back, taking out 3 more. Books stack up in our tiny apartment, by the bed, in the bathroom, in the galley kitchen. I take out books by people I've heard of, but have never had time to read. Books by authors I've heard speaking on the radio. Books translated from far-flung languages. Books by people who are still alive. Books I've seen in the pages of newspapers. All the books, in short, which didn't appear on my degree course. I read as I walk to work. I read on the underground trains. I read between my student slots. I read in the bath, watched from the ceiling by the leucistic gecko I have tamed, plying him with aphids I pluck from the window boxes. And one night, in the monsoon season, when the rain is a constant lulling hum outside the windows, when our clothes, the windows, the pictures are growing mould in the humidity, and it's too hot to sleep, when I have been reading subversive versions of European folk tales, I get the urge to put down some words. I get up, find a pencil, open an exercise book at the table, and as Anton sleeps, I start to write. Neck, 2002. When I am seized suddenly and roughly from behind, my first thought is that it's someone I know. An acquaintance is here, in Chile, by amazing and unaccountable coincidence, and has seen us, walking beside a lake, and has come up behind us to say hello, jumping on me in a playful fashion. Then I see Will's face, and I know it's nothing of the sort. There is a machete being held to my throat. Its long blade glints in the evening sun. I can feel its cool metallic caress against my skin, the insistence of the stranger's grip pinning my arms to my sides. In the disturbing intimacy of the embrace, his breath, laboured and hoarse, grazes my ear. Even though I can't see him, I sense that he's about my height and dark-haired. He hasn't washed for a while. I am aware of the onion tang of his armpits, the steel of his belt buckle in the small of my back, the tremble of his hands. He is scared. Will is scared, but I feel strangely removed, as if this isn't really happening. As if we haven't been apprehended by a machete-wielding man, but are continuing with our lakeside walk. Will is angry, too, I see, at this interruption, at this escapade. His face is white and scowling. I have known him for 10 years, have been in a relationship with him for 3, and I can see the whir of thought through his brain, can read it like ticker tape coming out of a machine. A machete, my girlfriend, a man, smaller than me, he looks pissed off. He looks murderous. We are in the first week of a long trip through South America. This little town beside a lake at the base of a volcano is our second stop. After this, we plan to head for the hills, travel deep into the Andes, where we've been told there is a place with a thermal spring and a farmer who will let you sleep in his barn. Will and I have just bought a flat in London, a red brick, end of terrace with a tiny rhomboid of garden out the back. A railway line runs alongside it, trains lumbering past in obverse directions, making the walls tremble and shudder, the window panes rattle. When we found it, it was semi-derelict, unused for years, the boards caving in, the Edwardian floral wallpaper slumping to the floor, the gas lamps leaking deltas of rusty red effluvia down the crumbling plaster. While we are in South America, the flat is being refloored, rewired, revivified, or at least we hope so. Missives from the builders are infrequent and unspecific. We will, we anticipate, return to electric lights, to floors that don't give way beneath our feet, to white walls, radiators, hot water, to opened-up fireplaces and a working oven. We have nowhere to live while this transformation takes place, so, rather than finding a temporary place, we have decided to come travelling until our flat is ready. It works out cheaper, we reasoned, to live in South America than renting in London. We would take our work with us, we could write on the run and email articles back to Britain. The perfect plan. Except that now a man is holding a machete to my neck and crooning "Dinaro" into my ear. "Dinaro." Then, in case we don't understand, "Money." Will doesn't move. He is standing in front of us now, his body tense and coiled. "Give him money," I croak, the blade pressing down on my windpipe. He still doesn't move. "Will," I whisper as the man gets a fistful of my hair and forces me to my knees, the machete grinding closer to my throat. "Please, give him the money." I see Will glance at the machete, at the man, at me, kneeling mutely before him, a blade held to my exposed neck like some strange, enforced marriage proposal tableau. And I know he is still assessing whether he can tackle this situation in kind. "Please," I say again. I see him relent. He reaches slowly into the pocket of his jacket. I remember, irrelevantly, that back in the hostel bedroom we debated whether or not we'd need coats before we went out. Was it cold? Did it look like rain? Were there clouds in the sky? Should we take a walk by the lake before dinner? Why not? Will holds out some notes. "Let her go," he says. The man darts forward to snatch the money, and the movement causes a sharp yank to my scalp. Through the pain, I glimpse a shock of black hair, a mouthful of stained teeth, jeans, a torn sweatshirt. He is young, younger than me, and clearly sleeping rough. What possessed us, I wonder, to take a walk in such a lonely, windy place? The money does not please him. He stuffs it into his back pocket with a grimace. "Mass!" he yells, slapping the ground with his machete blade. "Mass!" He cleans us out. We had only that day been to the bank and changed a whole wedge of travellers' checks. We were about to head off into the Andes and would need the cash. We had more money in our pockets and bags than we'd ever carried before at any time in our travels. The man takes it all from us, pulling it out from the various places in which we'd stashed it. We hand it to him in exchange for my neck, its arteries, its tendons, its muscles, its trachea, its esophagus, for it all to remain in its current, unbreached state. He doesn't let go of my hair. He keeps it wrapped around his fist throughout the robbery. His every twitch, his every movement causes my scalp to smart with pain. When we have no more money, when our pockets and wallets are empty, there is a suspended triangular moment as the three of us look at each other. Me at Will at the man at me. "What now?" we are all thinking. He is holding the machete in one hand, my hair in the other. His pockets are full of our money. The wind whisks around us, pleating the surface of the lake, smashing the trees back and forth in the darkening sky. The man pulls on my hair, forcing my head back and back. I can see only sky, scurrying clouds, the black arrows of birds. Back at the hostel, Will and I will talk about this moment, and we will both say that we thought the man might want more. More violence. More abuse. More horror. At the time, I gaze up at the sky, the birds, the fast-moving clouds, and I am thinking about the dense forest behind us, about how I do not want to be dragged in there, not at all. I do not want to see the trees closing over my head. Feel the scratch and pluck of bushes against my skin, my clothes, the cold damp of the ground in there. My thoughts are very simple. They pulse through my head. Let me go. Let me go. Not the forest. Not the ground. Please. I feel the beat of these thoughts. I imagine them passing through the bone of my skull, up the fibres of my hair, and transmitting themselves into the man's hand. Let me go, please. Also, know this. I will fight you. I will not go quietly. If you try to drag me away, I will battle you. I won't make it easy. I will struggle every step of the way with every last ounce of strength. Into my field of vision comes his face upside down. He looks at me. I look back at him. He seems to be considering something, going over his options. I hold his gaze. Don't do it, I will him. Don't. Take the money and go. I cast about with my hands to find something to hold on to. A branch, a rock, in case he tries to pull me somewhere. But there is nothing, only small pebbles that slide and slip through my fingers. He leans forward over me. Some decision has been reached. Run, he hisses. He yanks me to my feet and pushes me away from him towards Will. Run, he urges us again, pointing with his blade away from the town, away from the hostel, away from everything. You run! We sprint wordlessly along the edge of the lake, our breath entering and leaving our chests in sharp jags. My scalp throbs and stings, glowing with agony. I look back over my shoulder to check he isn't coming after us, with his angry grimace, his broken teeth, his unwashed hair, his machete curved like a scimitar. I see him hurrying away over the stones, vaulting a fence, disappearing back into the scrubby vegetation. Will pulls on my sleeve. We come to a halt and I hunch over, hands on my knees, trying to gulp down as much air as I can. I am nowhere near as fit as Will, who jogs and plays five-a-side football every week. Let's get out of here, he says, indicating the path back to town. Can you run? Later we sit at a table in the hostel. The owner, on hearing what happened, has scrawled on the whiteboard in reception in large capital letters, "Do not walk by the lake. There are armed robbers." She has also brought us cups of oversweetened tea for the shock, she says, patting my shoulder, which makes me flinch. Something has caught up with me now. The fear that beside the lake had held itself in check has invaded my body. My arms are shaking. I keep looking over my shoulder. When I raise the cup to my lips, its rim rattles against my teeth. In a few months' time, we will return to London. We will live in the rooms of the flat we have bought. The building work won't be anywhere near finished, but we move in anyway. The roof no longer leaks, the eroding gas lamps will have gone, but the toilet flushes with hot water, the walls click and rustle at night, and the garden is filled with rubble. We will circle each other in this flat, retreating to different rooms to work, to write. We don't know it, but these will be our final months as two people. Is there something about the experience beside the lake that pushed us forward, made us exit one stage of life and enter the next? Did my escape from under the machete impress upon both of us the fragility, the mutability of human life? Either way, it won't be much longer until I take a pregnancy test and sit there in our newly painted flat, staring at the stick, waiting to see if some blue lines are going to rise towards me. In the Chilean hostel, Will is feeling the need to talk about the robbery, to get the facts straight, the events in their correct order, to align my version with his. He goes over it, backwards, forwards, from this angle, from that. The way the man came up behind us, the way the wind must have snatched away the sound of his footsteps, the moment Will turned and saw a blade at my neck, how the man must have done it before, how he had clearly honed his method, how he wasn't that big. Will could have challenged him, could have got the machete away from him. He is sure he could. The way we had passed the man earlier, at the start of the walk, and Will had thought it was odd that he didn't meet our eyes, didn't respond to our nodded greeting. This last observation makes me raise my head. You know what? I say, and I start to tell him something. Something I'd never told anyone. Something that almost happened when I was 18 and on a walk alone. Abdomen, 2003. I had been distantly aware of a person to my left for some time. It was a man, nearing middle age, in hospital scrubs and mask, standing with his back against the wall of the operating theatre, just outside my field of vision. He was not taking part, but watching, just watching, his hands behind his back, like someone at a tennis match. I had wondered, fleetingly, what he was doing there, hanging around at the fringes of an emergency caesarean section with apparently nothing to do. But then events overtook me and I stopped wondering about anything at all. I still don't know who this man was, and I never will. His scrubs were beige, everyone else's were blue. Was he a hospital orderly, a surgical student, a porter, a nurse? I have no idea. What I did know at the time of our encounter in the operating theatre was three things. That the baby was out, and somewhere over in the corner, screaming and being attended to. That I was desperate to lay eyes on him, that I was in trouble. My heart was suddenly galloping, as if trying to outrun whatever it was that was catching up with us. Will was being gripped by the arm and hustled away by a nurse. The floor was awash with blood and people were running. It is never a good sign, I found, when medics run. On the whole, they are an unflappable, rational breed with a deliberately neutral demeanour. It's only when you see this facade slip, if they hurry or raise their voices, that you need to worry. The doctors on the other side of a hastily erected curtain were treading red shoe prints as they worked. One, a young woman from Northern Ireland, was panicking, saying, I can't, I don't know how. I caught sight of a forearm, scarlet to the elbow, swiping at a sweaty brow. The other doctor, a taciturn man in his 30s, said something sharp to her, then fell silent. The anaesthetists, who, until a moment ago, were sitting next to me, chatting and joking, were now standing, watching what was happening over the curtain. Their faces were still, stony, careful. One adjusted his half-moon spectacles and did something to the clear suspended bag on a drip stand. Whatever it was hit my veins almost immediately, and I felt myself veer sideways like a train diverted to a different track. Felt something like a fog blow over my brain. My eyes rolled back in my skull. I saw the ceiling tiles moving like a conveyor belt. I saw the underside of the anaesthetist's chin, reddish bristles poking through the skin. I saw a defective light flicker on and off. I forced my eyelids to stay open. I pressed my fingernails into my palms. I needed to remain in the here and now. I should not give in to whatever was pulling me under. There was a baby. I needed to stay. When I was heavily pregnant, I met an off-duty consultant obstetrician at a party. "The thing about childbirth," he slurred to me in a confidential tone, gesturing with his wine glass towards my stomach, "is that it's either all fine or it completely fucks up. There's nothing in between." Not the most comforting pronouncement, but perhaps one of the most honest. When I got pregnant, I was blithely unaware of the highly politicised arena of elective caesareans in the UK. I'd never heard of what was then called the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, or NICE, as it was known to its friends, or its strict surgical guidelines as to how many caesareans were permitted per month per hospital. I tripped along to my appointment at a large London hospital with a friendly registrar who would, months later, be the one to say, I can't, I don't know how, as I was bleeding out on the operating table. I explained to her that as a child I'd had a virus that meant I was in a wheelchair for a year and left me with mild muscle, nerve and brain damage. The neurologists and paediatricians who had looked after me said that, should I ever have children, I would need a caesarean. I had sustained damage to the neuromuscular junctions in my spine and pelvis, which meant that labour would begin but not progress. The contractions would not be strong enough. I wanted to ask the registrar what she thought. I would have preferred a natural childbirth, and this diagnosis was, after all, 20 years old. I had rehearsed this speech, pared it back to its bare bones. I knew the registrar would be busy. that there would be long queues in the antenatal department, that I would need to get across the salient information about my childhood encephalitis and no more. All I wanted from her was her opinion. What did she think were my chances of a natural birth? But I got halfway through my speech before the registrar nervously interrupted me. "I'll have to check this with the consultant," she said, and scurried away. I waited. I looked around the room. I studied the lists of foods forbidden during pregnancy. I tried to read my notes upside down. The door flew open. A tall man with severe comb tracks in his black hair came in, the registrar behind him. She introduced me, and he took my proffered hand, but instead of shaking it, he used it to yank me bodily up out of my seat. "Get up," were his first words to me. "Let me see you walk." I wish now I'd left there and then, but at the time, I was so astonished I complied. "There's nothing wrong with you," he pronounced after he'd seen me take two steps. "You will have a normal delivery." I started to ask for clarification, but the consultant, we'll call him Mr. C, talked over me. "Cesareans were a cult," he said, "a fashion. I had been reading too many gossip magazines." I assured him this was not the case, but he shouted me down again. Did I realize that cesareans constituted major surgery? Why had I allowed myself to be swayed by celebrities? Did I doubt his medical expertise? What was wrong with me that I was so afraid of a bit of pain? Angry now, I attempted to say that I was in fact quite used to pain, but he surveyed me with an expression of utmost contempt. "This illness you claim to have had..." He turned at this point to eyeball the registrar, who was hovering by the door. "Encephalitis, was it?" The registrar nodded, and Mr. C turned his gaze back to me. "Do you have any proof?" he said, a slight but triumphant smirk curling his lips. "Proof?" I repeated, incredulous. "You think I'm lying?" Mr. C shrugged but continued to stare at me in a way that seemed practiced, habitual. Was this his tried-and-tested method for humiliating pregnant women into submitting to his will? It seemed that way. "Well, I suppose I could get my old hospital notes," I said, after a moment, holding his gaze. "Would that be sufficient proof for you?" "You can't bully me," was the subtext of this. Mr. C saw that, and it angered him further. "They'll date from the early 1980s, I continued, "and will come from South Wales, but I'm sure that can be arranged." He narrowed his eyes, tapped his pen on the desk, and then Mr. C had had enough of me. He rose to his feet, dismissing me with a wave, and delivered his parting shot. "If you'd come to me in a wheelchair, maybe then I would have given you a caesarean." It was an extraordinary thing to say to anyone, let alone someone who has actually been confined to a wheelchair. It wasn't Mr. C's refusal to discuss my case, never mind grant me an elective caesarean, that horrified me. It was his implication that I was some kind of malingering coward trying to lie my way into an easy birth. That and his appalling, patronizing bullying. Did I realize that a caesarean was major surgery? No, I thought it was a stroll in the park. It was only when I got outside that I started to shake, in much the same way as I had when I was in the grip of viral immobility. Ataxia is the word for it, a wavering of the limbs, a tremble, an inability to walk or coordinate. I leant up against the hospital wall, alongside the smokers, the idling ambulances, people waiting for their taxis, trying to understand, to catch up with what had just happened. To be so unheard, so disregarded, so disbelieved, I was unprepared for this. I also felt helpless, blocked in. I wanted to run from that hospital and never go back, but how else would the baby be born? I needed this place. I was trapped, pregnant. This baby would have to come out in less than 5 months, and what would happen if the neurologist's predictions came true? What then? What if my body was unable to birth this child? I had been foolish, selfish in getting pregnant. I should never have allowed it if I wasn't up to the task of giving birth. What had I been thinking? People left me alone, stepping around me. A person leaning against a wall outside a hospital, shocked and silent, is not an unusual or unlikely sight. Eventually, a man with a crutch and a dripstand, nautical tattoos swarming up his arms, limped over and offered me a cigarette. I thanked him and shook my head, pointing to the curve of my stomach. "Kids," he said to me genially in a strong Cork accent, "they'll have you in an early grave." When I got home, Will, after some initial shock at my dishevelled appearance, listened to my incoherent, rambling account of the appointment. He paced up and down the living room for a while. Then he phoned the hospital. He spoke to the Northern Irish registrar, who said that, yes, I could change hospitals if I wanted to, but the other options were quite a distance from where we lived. What might be better, she said, was if I stayed at the hospital but changed consultants. I wouldn't have to see or speak to Mr. C ever again if that was what I wanted. That was exactly and precisely what I wanted, never to see him again. So I stayed at the local hospital. I changed consultants. I scribbled out every instance of Mr. C's name from my notes with indelible ink and wrote in the new woman's name. I obliterated him from all my records, all my plans, all my folders. He was to have nothing more to do with me or my baby. As things turned out, the predictions of the neurologists from the 1980s were right. My labour went on and on, but didn't progress. My contractions surged forward, then weakened off. They felt to me like the apogee of pain, of agony. It was as if my body was trying to turn itself inside out. But the nurses frowned at the monitor strapped to my belly. "Not strong enough," they said. "Fading away," they said. I kept trying to explain. Will kept trying to explain. "The thing is," I said, addressing a midwife whom Will had grabbed by the arm, "I had acute encephalitis as a child, severe cerebellar ataxia, neurological damage, vestibular malfunction. Please check my birth plan, my notes. It's all in there. My neuromuscular junctions are..." Here I yanked the gas and air mask off my face. They are faulty, and they said I'd need... Wait, where are you going? Come back. On the morning of my third day in labour, who should appear at my bedside but Mr. C? I looked up at him from the bed. He looked back, his lip curled. Did he remember me from our meeting all those months ago? Had he seen the traces of his name scored out of my notes? I wanted to shout, "Not you! Anyone but you!" But I knew in some shape or form that my baby's life was in his hands. My life was in his hands. He was the only consultant on duty that morning. There was no other. So I was polite. I was controlled. I didn't shout. I didn't ask him to leave. I may have even smiled as I begged him for a caesarean, from my prone position on a bed, getting out the words between contractions. He glanced at the charts of my baby's dipping heart rate, read over my notes, perused my birth plan, then granted me surgery in the manner of a landowner bestowing a favour on a serf. But Mr. C still had me down as a hysteric, a fantasist, a malingerer, a reader of celebrity gossip. It would, he said, go down in my records as by maternal request. That is, medically unnecessary. This, despite 3 days of labour, the induction drugs, the non-progression, the diagnosis by neurologists. The next day, after my messed-up C-section, the surgeon came to visit to see how I was, to explain what had gone wrong. The problem, he told me as I sat up in bed attempting to breastfeed, had been that the baby had become wedged in what is termed stargazer presentation, a position that makes natural delivery impossible. My labour had been allowed to go on for so long without progressing that the baby had turned the wrong way, his spine aligning with mine, and because my cervix hadn't dilated, his chin was forced down and the widest part of his head was facing the exit. Head down, looking up. Some of us are looking at the stars. His left ear was so crushed and misshapen by the pressure of the contractions that went nowhere that it would require plastic surgery. The baby's wedged and immovable position made it difficult for the surgeons to remove him, and somehow in the ensuing wrestling and grappling, clutching and heaving, something had ruptured. All that should have stayed inside had come out. "What would have happened," I asked the surgeon, the man who had replaced my intestines and stopped my bleeding, sewn me up and saved my life, 100 years ago if you had a stargazer baby? The surgeon looked up from his notes. He seemed to be considering the question, debating whether or not to tell me the truth. "You wouldn't have made it," he said, eventually going back to whatever it was he was writing. "What about the baby?" "The baby would have died first," he said, not looking up. "Then the mother, of sepsis, probably days later." Death by childbirth seems such an outdated danger, such a distant threat, particularly in the surroundings of hospitals in the developed world. But a recent survey ranked the UK at 30 out of 179 countries for maternal health. In the UK, a woman faces a 1 in 6,900 chance of dying in childbirth, which far exceeds the risk in Poland, 19,800, Austria, 19,200, or Belarus, 45,200. The US ranked lower than the UK at 33, with a woman facing a 1 in 1,800 chance of maternal death. At 179 is Somalia. All but two of the 11 lowest-ranking countries in the world are in West and Central Africa. The most common cause of maternal mortality worldwide is postpartum hemorrhage. When I was a child, we were taken every Christmas to see a pantomime. I found these to be disturbing, hectic events. Men in dresses, with balloon breasts, shouting like maniacs. Children from the audience, taken up on stage to stand there, tongue-tied and blinking. Adults dressed as rabbits and hedgehogs hurling boiled sweets into the auditorium. Heavy velvet curtains with gold frogging. And then, most disquieting of all, a thick, flesh-coloured blind dropping down, emblazoned with the harrowing words, "Fire Curtain." I remember seeing a man shut a spangle-leotarded woman inside a box, her feather-adorned head protruding at one end and her tiny slippered feet at the other. He then proceeded to slice the box in half, the serrated teeth of the saw hacking and grinding as they slid further and further through the beautiful, gaudy girl. What horrified me most as a child was that she smiled the whole time, her teeth bared towards us, lips drawn back, even when the man swung open the box to show us the severed vacancy that he, madman, murderer, psychotic, had created while we just sat in our seats and gawped, inert as argon. The leotard woman flashes through my mind as I lie there on the operating table, sliced open, ruptured, bleeding, my intestinal tract unravelled on the wrong side of my skin. Whatever it is the surgeons are doing to me on the other side of the curtain is rough, violent, violating. I am not smiling. I am not wiggling my sequined toes. I am being shunted up the table bit by bit until my head rests on the metal edge. I can feel hands rummaging through my innards as far up as my ribs. Still the blood comes. I catch my first glimpse of the baby, my son, far away across the room, and his face is uncertain, anxious, his brow furrowed, as if he is not sure he likes what he sees. It is an expression I will catch on his face sometimes, even as a teenager. I say something like, "Bring him here," and he turns his eyes towards me, as if my voice is the only familiar thing for him in the room. We have agreed, Will and I, that he will stay with the baby in any eventuality. "Don't let it out of your sight," I have exhorted him late at night when I have been worrying about the birth, about hospitals in general. I have read too many novels and watched too many films about babies swapped at birth, babies who weren't issued with an identity bracelet. My grandmother used to tell the story of how she was brought a baby to feed in hospital, and she knew it wasn't hers. "Of course it's yours," the nurse had replied. But my grandmother was no pushover. She rose from her bed and went down the ward, checking each cubicle until she'd located her baby, my future aunt, who had been given to another woman. "Whatever happens, I'd said to Will over and over again. You stay with the baby at all times. He is keeping his promise. The problem is that I can't see them anymore. They seem to have been taken elsewhere, behind a screen or into another room. I am given more of whatever is in the drip, and my head is hanging off the end of the table. I raise my hand. I'm not sure now what for. To call a halt? To say enough? To say, help me, please? Either way, what happens next is that the man in beige is suddenly there. He has stepped towards me, away from his wall, and he takes my raised hand. He enfolds it in both of his. I gaze up at him, mutely. I had not known, until that moment, what a lonely experience it is to be in danger, in the middle of a room full of people who are frantically working to save your life. I am not prone to loneliness. I have always been someone who leans towards solitude. But my overwhelming sensation had been, until that moment, loneliness, isolation, bafflement. I was slipping away, alone, surrounded by people. The man is wearing those spectacles that react to light, so his eyes are hidden behind brown-tinted lenses. He has thick, wiry hair cut close to his head. More hair sprouts over the top of his surgical scrubs. He moves my hand so that it is curled around his wrist, and he places his other hand on top of it. His touch is infinitely gentle but firm and sure. There is no way he is letting go, he is telling me, entirely without words. He's going to stay right here, and I am going to stay right here. I clutch at him with the force of a drowning woman. He nods once down at me, and a grave, slow smile lifts above the edges of his surgical mask. I wonder sometimes if I imagined him, if he was the figment of a panicking, threatened mind. He wasn't, though. He was there. It was real. Our interaction was entirely wordless. I don't even know if he spoke English. He stayed with me while they stitched and stapled me together again. He took the weight of my head and shoulders as they lifted me from the operating table onto a gurney. He was there when they pushed me into a ward. After that, I lost sight of him. I was suddenly surrounded by nurses who were swabbing me down, rearranging drip stands, asking about drugs, painkillers, transfusions. Someone brought in the baby. Did the man see me reunited with my son? I hope so. When he took my hand, he taught me something about the value of touch, the communicative power of the human hand. I didn't know, as I lay there, that I would think of him many times in the years ahead. When my son lay on a hospital bed, age 4, with the raging fever of meningitis, I reached through the bodies of the attending doctors and held his slack, heated hand in both of mine. When my youngest child disappeared beneath the waves of the Mediterranean Sea and I had to leap in, haul her out, turn her upside down so that the water drained from her lungs, then all she and I could do was sit on the sand, wrapped in towels, contemplating what had almost happened, her small fingers wrapped in mine. When my middle child had eczema so torturous it made her scream and writhe through the night, I would press my hands over hers to stop the scratching, to ease her back towards sleep. The people who teach us something retain a particularly vivid place in our memories. I'd been a parent for about 10 minutes when I met the man, but he taught me, with a small gesture, one of the most important things about the job. Kindness, intuition, touch, and that sometimes you don't even need words. Baby in Bloodstream, 2005. It was nothing you did, the nurse says. It's not your fault. I am silent. I had not thought it might be. I look again at the image of the baby on the screen. There it is, sitting up in its dark cave, as if waiting for something, as if on best behaviour. If I sit straight, it seems to be saying, no one will notice. I know how it should be, how it should look. This is, after all, my second pregnancy. I know the heartbeat should be there, flashing and flashing, like a siren. So when the radiologist says that he's sorry, the baby is dead, I already know. But I carry on staring at the monitor because there is some frail, furled part of me that is hoping there has been a mistake, that the heartbeat might suddenly appear, that the scanning machine might roll further, and there it will be. I can't look away from the screen, even when the radiologist starts talking again, even when they say I can get down from the bed and get dressed. I want to burn the image of that tiny, ghost-pale form into my retina. I want to remember it, to honour its existence, however short. We are shown into a room. It is down a corridor and around a corner, away from the antenatal department, away from all the other women waiting for their scans. This room has curtains. The chairs have cushions. There is a large, leather-covered book on a table, and a sign above it says, Book of Remembrance. The bad news room, Will mutters, as he stares out of the window as he examines the charts on the wall. And I nod. I cannot stop crying, which is odd because I usually can if I need to. I perch on the edge of a chair and tell myself I have to stop, I have to get myself under control, but I can't. Will hands me a cushion, for some reason, and I take it. I hold it carefully, conscientiously, on my knee. It was nothing you did. The nurse comes in. She makes a show of shutting the door very gently, as if the noise might be too much for us. It's what we call a missed miscarriage, she says, where the fetus has died but not come away. I nod again, several times, because I am still unable to speak. I think about how the phrase missed miscarriage must be hard to say. I wonder if the nurse has had to practice it to say it so smoothly. It's the kind of sound pattern that would trip up a stammerer, those clusters of double consonants, the repeated I sound. I experience a transient irrational relief that I never became an antenatal nurse, that I never went down that particular career path. Imagine the horror of stammering as you gave someone this news, of being suddenly unable to get out the words. I almost mention this to the nurse, almost compliment her on how well she pronounced the phrase, how seamlessly she said it. I arrive at the decision just in time that this probably isn't appropriate. She tells me I have three options. I can have a surgical removal under general anaesthetic. I can go home and wait to see if things start naturally. That, I say, lifting my head, I'll do that. Around 1 in 5 pregnancies ends in miscarriage. Up to 75% of these occur in the first trimester. The risk of pregnancy loss then, in the first 12 weeks, is 15%. 1 in 100 women experience recurrent miscarriages. A third of women in the UK attending specialist clinics as a result of miscarriage are clinically depressed. We all, I think, know these statistics, or at least have a vague sense of them. We know miscarriages out there, at our backs, pursuing us, like Andrew Marvell's winged chariot. It's why you're not supposed to tell people you're pregnant until you've passed the magic 12-week point, until you come out of hospital clutching a monochrome sonogram picture. Only then can you inform your friends, your in-laws, your employers. Only then can you go out and buy wireless bras and stretchy tops. Only then can you leave your antenatal vitamin bottles lying about the house with impunity. Only then will you start getting calls from relatives, suggesting old family names, insisting that the daily drinking of Guinness is crucial for breastfeeding, offering knitted matinee jackets, stiff with age. I've never understood the blanket secrecy you're supposed to apply to early pregnancy. Certainly I've never felt the need to broadcast the news far and wide, but it seems to me that pregnancy at any stage is significant, life-changing enough to warrant telling those closest to you. Even if something as devastating as pregnancy loss happens, wouldn't you want your close friends, your family, to know? Who else would you turn to at such a time? How else do you explain the grief, the stunned pain on your face, the tears, the shock. Because losing a baby, a fetus, an embryo, a child, a life, even at a very early stage, is a shock like no other. Intellectually, you know it's a possibility. As soon as you get the line on a test stick, you look every day for the telltale sign of blood. You tell yourself it might happen. You tell yourself not to build things up, not to expect too much, to be sensible.